Crack Life was a little spin-off project from work we were doing on an estate in Luton with a group called Exodus over a period of maybe 10 years. By the time we did that one, we're still in contact with people from that community now. Started working with them in 1995. Okay, so we're going to do a little quick kind of romp through various examples, giving a little bit of a kind of journey through my work, at least, and in this area. And each one of these extracts we're going to use hopefully will bring out, or we can elaborate on their approach and how they might be interesting to you in how you might think about using participatory video. But just to begin with, I mean, my background is I'm one of those people who kind of knew I wanted to work with film when I was quite young. And I was always, you know, 10, 11, 12 kind of age. I was always very interested in the documentary side of filmmaking. And the school sausage system kind of pushed me out, and I ended up finding myself doing a degree up at Norwich that I wasn't even interested in doing. And I just kind of dropped out completely, and someone said to me, "Oh, did you know you can do a BA in film?" And I went to what was then called the London College of Printing, which was where they did the first ever BA in filmmaking, and there were 12 of us on the course. So I go back there occasionally, and now there's like 120 students with not much more equipment, I have to say. And this is in the kind of punk era, 77 to 80. The very first film project outside of the university, that out of LCP that I did, was about Milton Keynes. I was very interested in the kind of utopian aspirations of new towns versus the kind of Thatcherite reality of them. And one of the struggles to make films was everything was really expensive, but getting access to editing equipment was very difficult. And I'd always had an interest in kind of community-based activities, and one of my projects at the LCP had been around community video. But I volunteered for what were the very earliest in the UK community video projects. One was called Oval Video, based at Oval House in Kennington. The building's still there. I'm not sure that anything else is, but it was turned into predominantly a community theatre. And the other one was Albany in Deptford, which is definitely still there. There's a purpose-built theatre building. But these were two of the very earliest ideas of kind of community-based video, council-funded, let's pay some wages, let's buy a little bit of equipment, and local people can come and use the technology. And I was doing some, you know, volunteering there, really, and in a way, volunteering so that I could, you know, with their agreement, come in maybe at night sometimes and edit up bits of my Milton Keynes film. And I was in there one day, and some people came in and said, "Look, we're squatters, we're living in this building round the corner, and we're squatting it to stop a council house being sold." It was one of the very first, it was an experiment in sales of council housing under early days, so 1981 we're talking about. And the people at the Albany kind of said, "Well, no, we can't help you." A bit with that kind of like, "You're not real local," kind of attitude. You know, I think English people know what I mean. You're not a real local kind of thing. And that kind of annoyed me a lot, actually. And I just sort of was there and I said, "Well, I'll do it. I'll come and film stuff." So the very first video I made in that context was a black and white video working with the squatters in that house. Interestingly enough, Jeremy Corbyn's brother was one of the main spokespeople for that group. But it was and what it meant to me was that because of the way council funding operated, it was all a bit top down. You know, the council would prioritise, let's say, teenage girls on a particular housing estate, which was fine. I mean, I had no problem with that. But there was no room for anything that didn't fit these kind of predetermined funding-led criteria. And here were people with common purpose. Obviously, some of them were indeed locals who lived in the houses that were being sold and had got militant about it. But in this kind of view, top-down view of community video, it was they were a bit excluded. So the very first film I made under that was called Kilner House, What Against the Sales. And I edited it at Albany in Deptford. And I couldn't get I was interested to work in this area, and I ended up getting a job in a very kind of classic community arts project over in Whitechapel. And Whitechapel at that time was one of a very different place to the East End of today. It was a place where the National Front, the fascist party in the UK, it was their street, basically. Brick Lane was where they sold their newspapers. It's now famous as a sort of Bengali run street, really. And this was, it was called the Tower Hamlets Arts Project. And what it did predominantly with video was document community performances and activities. It was just used as a way of getting a record of a kid's drama workshop or performance or whatever. And I was interested in, as I said, more kind of journalistic approach, more communities of interest rather than communities based in a particular location or whatever. And so I had the opportunity to, from a blank sheet of paper, as it were, design a workshop structure. And I came up with this idea of a group called Despite TV, which was going to make a video magazine. And what a video magazine was be half an hour of video that where no one thing was longer than 5 minutes. And it was a mix of politics, music, humour, bit of local history, maybe local band, poets. So it was, you know, kind of a bit of everything. And it was an open cooperative. And this is because it was an open group and I didn't exist and there were no people until I invited them in. I had the opportunity, as I say, to kind of completely design the structure. And those principles I was talking to you about the other day were the ones that I actually put into the structure of Despite TV. There were a few other little rules and regulations about, like, the fact that we defined something that was called task work, which was all the things no one wants to do, like the cleaning the toilets. You don't join a group to go and clean the toilets, but it's stuff has to be done. So we would define stuff as task work, and in order to be a member of this group, you just had to make sure that you did your 2 hours every 3 months or whatever it was of task work. You know, no postal votes on discussions. It was very active. People would find themselves going to their second meeting and chairing it. And the group lasted about 10 years. So there would be people turning up, chairing a meeting where there were some people in the room who had been there for years, and they were the new person, and suddenly they're chairing it. So we saw it work and we saw it operate. And I'll just give you just a little quick taster of just the kind of randomness of the kind of stuff that we used to produce.
There are people dying. Oh, when it's time lend a hand to life, the greatest gift of all. We could go on pretending day by day that someone somewhere will soon make a change. We all a part of God's great big family. And the truth, you know, love is all we need.
We are the world. We are the children. We are the ones who make it brighter again. So let's start giving.
What Despite TV's aim was to produce a video magazine. And a video magazine basically means that you can have a half-hour magazine that's made up of X number of items, if you like, video articles or a band or a poet or something. Nothing could be longer than 5 minutes. That was the aim of the group, nothing else. That was all we had as an aim to achieve. We aimed to try and do one every couple of months, but, you know, we just did them when we could, really. There were a few basic ground rules. Because I had the luxury of just designing it from a blank sheet of paper, I could make up any rules that I felt like. And this was completely informal, by the way. It's something I often forget to mention, that when it started, it was an adult education institute evening class. So it was funded by the local adult education. You'll see their credit later. So it later became a formal co-op where these things were actually put into the rules of the co-op. But the basic structure is that the aim was to make a magazine. You had to live or work in Hackney Tower Hamlets and Newham. I mean, you know, in those days, you couldn't realistically make something open London-wide. I mean, if we were in a smaller city, maybe. But it was also about who was funding. Tower Hamlets won't fund people to get educated who live in Hackney, you know, for goodness sakes. So we had to have some limit to, but we were, you know, live or work, so that was pretty broad. All the decisions would be made in a weekly meeting, adult education. It was in the programme in Tower Hamlets, Learn Video, 7 till 9 above the bookshop, Whitechapel Road. And, the people who came along automatically were just part of the group. The group was whoever was in the room at that time. And all the editorial decisions were made in this two-hour meeting. As the group got developed, we just occasionally had a slightly longer meeting to deal with administrative stuff, which I'll talk about later. But every decision had to be made by consensus, which meant that everyone had to agree anything that went into the magazine. Consensus is a really useful tool for participatory work because it enforces the minority voice to be heard. And there, what it basically means is if you've got like 10 people in the room and someone says, I think that's sexist, and you go, well, let's have a vote, you know, okay, no, you're wrong, and you're outvoted, okay, next. So that's how like voting works, if, you know, at best. But consensus means you can't move forward till everyone's moving, agreed to move forward. And of course, you know, we're socialized animals. People don't like just put their foot on the throat of an organization indefinitely because they're... But what it does mean is you have to hear, okay, what's your argument? And very often, if you hear the argument, I've seen, you know, that one person, normally it's a bit more, you know, a split and discussion, but I've seen one person turn everyone else to their way of thinking once they'd explained why they felt it was racist or sexist or ineffective. And it's a good way to operate a meeting. And it isn't really that much less, people say, oh, it's inefficient. Well, we made two or three broadcast programs with a group. And in fact, Despite TV made, without changing its rules, a TV program completely running on the consensus. So no decision making by vote, which means you can't have absentee voting. You know, you can't have this a dominant group who can't be asked to go to the meeting, but like send in advance how they would vote type thing. And we rotated roles, and in terms of the group meetings, we rotated chair. So the chair, and the reason to do that is to, all of these rules are all about trying to create a flat, non-hierarchical environment for people to be creative in. So the reason for rotating the roles is because it shows that the role of a chair isn't a power role, it's a facilitating role. It's about making sure that the agenda gets discussed in the time allowed, that everyone has their chance to say, that there's, you know, that we they're checking, do we all agree? No, so, you know, okay, well, let's talk about it more and stuff like that. So you don't, it's not a power thing. So a rotating chair in the case of Despite TV meant, I mean, Despite TV lasted 10 years on this thin soup. It generated a huge amount of content, but it was quite often a situation where someone might be going to their second meeting that most of the other people in the room have been in the group for a year, some 7, 8, I was there all the way through, and they're suddenly chairing a meeting. Or they're taking the minutes. That was another thing we rotated. You know, it's not difficult. You just have to write down the decisions in the minutes book. So everyone in the group, you know, being a member of the group just meant you had to take your turn to chair, you had to take your turn to do the minutes, and you had to do what we call a little bit, you know, maybe 4 hours every quarter or whatever it was of what we call task work. And task work was all those things that have to be done that no one joins a group to do. I mean, we did, you know, like cleaning the toilets is the classic example. You don't join a group because you really want to clean the toilets, but it's just something that has to be done. So rather than just dumping on one person, you could volunteer for, we didn't put that as task list, but it might be taking some equipment to be repaired. It might be, you know, someone wants us to screen a magazine at a school, who can go and do it or whatever. So there might be, we would agree in the group what is and what isn't task work. We would announce the task work. It was all voluntary. No one said, well, it's about time you did it. You know, you had to volunteer for it. But if you, by the end of the quarter, hadn't done your quota, you're out. Because that was what you required. You could rejoin again, but you're out. So you have to start the clock again. So that was just a way to avoid absentee power. We also did, and they weren't written down, but things like we'd insist that people sat in a circle. So we had a room that was big enough for us to sit in a circle, but we wouldn't have this outer circle who may be sitting on desks so they're slightly higher and sort of got a panopticon over all those, all the sort of people down in the on the ground level, or breathing, you know, behind them. So we would always, and when we've gone outside and done workshops in other venues, we've always insisted that the seating's in a circle and that there is no outer circle. The funny thing is, we did a big presentation at the weekend, and we had exactly that, which was the people who came late, they all left their camera off. So we had three pages of gallery view, and the last page, all the people who came late. Or, you know, this is where power can flow, especially where if you're dealing with young people or you've got youth workers working with young people. These people who hover in the background in the doorway, they're either in or they're out, like framing, you know. And if you're in, you're in this flat circle with everyone else. So that was another rule. When we later, it was a long time through, despite TV's history, that it happened. But there was a principle of open accounting. And that's a really strong, you know, I would really recommend you do something like that. If you're involved in a project where there's money involved, or there's, you know, what you don't want, and, you know, I had it even up in Luton, even after, you know, new people would, oh, you know, Mark's making a film for Channel 4, the budget's 60 grand. You know, he must have it all in his back pocket. You know, come on, Mark, give us a fiver so I can buy a packet of cigarettes. You're loaded, you know, type stuff. It can be very, very corrosive and damaging if there's, like, misunderstood ideas about. So you can actually show people. So when we, in Despite TV, we were only dealing with, like, 20 quid here, 100 quid there. But when we had 50 grand television budget, just went through as if it was no difference to how we operated. So that would just be, oh, we had this money in, we sold some VHS copies to a university, we've got 50 quid, we spent 30 quid getting something repaired, we need to buy some new tapes, okay, how to spend it. The thing about open accounting is that with some of the projects that have been broadcast, like the Channel 4 one, the film, you know, the group were I don't know, I'm jumping ahead. I'll save that for later. So the magazine format allowed, and this structure, so anything that was suggested, anyone could suggest content for the magazine. If it was approved, anyone could join in the making of it. And the rotation idea was the same, that if people went out, it was a small crew of two or three people, they would have to rotate round. It's not just the best person doing camera and the other person just holding the clipboard or the mics or whatever. It was, you know, they had to rotate round. And we've even got to the point where, you know, in mid-interview, the camera person changes place with the interviewer and the sound person, and they rotate round and then carry on with a different interviewer. And we'll show you an example later of how that might work. So the idea is A, to create a sort of flat, non-hierarchical environment where it's open, that all the power is in the people who are active and not sort of absentee decision makers. That anyone could join in. You couldn't say, "Oh, you don't do camera on this shoot because you've never done it before." That was exactly the whole point, is that they should do it. So, because otherwise they're never going to get better. Which of course means that there were some really frustrating times where things didn't go so well. But a lot of people learned very fast how to make stuff, and some of them went off to have careers as independent, you know, doing, you know, filmmaking or whatever. I mean, I think over the 10-year life of Despite TV, we calculated even halfway through that time that we'd have more than 300 people come through. But there are also people who were there for 8 years, seven, 6 years type thing as well. And having this structure meant it wasn't, you know, you don't have your new members and your old members and your old members sit back and go, well, it's all very well for you young uns to have a discussion, but it's going to be like this. So that's what Consensus did. And the magazine format and that structure meant that you could maximise individual creativity, individual passion, that, you know, I'm, or anger, you know, I'm furious about this story. I want to make an item in the magazine about that. Yeah, great. So we were next to London Hospital in East London. We'd have a nurses or a nurse join the group and make something about one of the early nurses' strikes, which might come round again. And they made an item about the nurses' strike. And they used it, of course, in the context of the strike. So that was fine by us, as long as the master lived in the project. So it was a way of maximising individual interest, passion, with a collectivising the equipment, the space, the labour involved. It's a group activity, let's have a look at. So the kind of thing we would do is only when you join the group, you were given some very basic training in the first week or so of your involvement. And that would mean, like, if we decided we were going to go, what we're going to show you is the footage comes from the announcement that the Docklands Light Railroad was going to be opened for this day. So everything that happened in Canary Wharf was on our doorstep. People went out, shot loads of random stuff, and we edited it together to this bit of music. Didn't have to worry about copyright.
Someone stopped the clock when we should have started early. If we miss the morning meeting, our lives will be in danger. Someone's trying to stop us. There is someone in our party. It is someone with a grudge, and they won't let us reach the border.
First driverless train, the day after we shot that, it flew off the tracks the day after it was launched. We covered that story in a later. True. So one of the interesting thing about rotating around roles is we kind of did it almost to an absurd level. You know, someone might be doing, we might go and interview someone, and sort of a third of the way through, the camera person becomes the interviewer takes over the camera, and the camera person does the sound, and it's like, you know, what's going on here? And it was a way to ensure that we didn't have people kind of dominating, specialising, saying, I'm the best camera operator. This is too important to let so-and-so do the camera. No. Everyone's going to do it. So people learn a lot very fast. So one of the things you saw there in that sequence, there were some images of people who were protesting against this city airport. It actually exists these days. It's one of London's big airports. And the story is that the development corporation promised all the residents, because there's high-rise flats all the way around it. If you've ever landed there, your wheels almost like touch a few tower blocks on the way in. It's like a good white knuckle ride if you're into that kind of thing. They were promised there would never be jets arriving at City Airport. Big promise. I absolutely promise there won't be. So we knew that that wasn't true. We followed that story a little bit. But what was interesting is that because we had we were constantly knocking on Channel 4's door. Channel 4 started in the UK in 1984. It's the model for those in Europe of ARTA, this kind of being a publishing house for more diverse, possibly even radical content. And that was the reputation of Channel 4. And we kept knocking on their door, and they just saw us as high risk, a cooperative of floating 12 people who, you know. We just never managed to get them interested. But eventually we got them to agree to give us a so-called development money. Development money is like when you go and pitch an idea and they go, here's $5,000, go and make a pilot or develop it more and then come back and we'll discuss it. And of course we used that to invest in some equipment and stuff. It's Development Corporation. It was a guy called Reg Ward. And he absolutely refused to ever talk to any of the people involved in the campaign against Newham Airport. Absolutely point blank refused over a long period of time. But we contacted him and we said, you know, hi Reg, you know, we didn't say it like that, but we said, Reg, you know, we'd like to come and interview you. We're doing Channel 4. He couldn't get us in there quick enough. He invited us into his prestigious office. And we did an interview with rotating interviewee. And this is what happened.
Here we had an area which had been in savage decline over a long period of time. Of its 5,000 acres, perhaps half of it were lying derelict with apparently no hope for any fresh development of any kind. And what we had to do from day one was totally change the perception of the area.
So this is a pastiche of a current cigarette advert for Silvercup. So what he didn't expect was the interviewer was one of the people that he refused to talk to.
He's not planned. We could have had regeneration in Docklands. We had a marvellous opportunity to really regenerate for the benefit of everybody who was living there. But you have had a market-led approach. I can't remember what it was Connie was asking you about, but she said it was planned, and you said it was an accidental fault. I mean, what a way to plan the regeneration of that area by accidental faults, by market-led, by seeing what you could get the highest price for, instead of looking at it as a whole and saying, these are the needs, this is how we could go about meeting the needs, these are the jobs we could create.
You've grabbed the land, which was the council. We've got people, 4 and 5 children in 1 bedrooms down there, and Newham Council cannot house them because you've taken the land where they were going to build council.
Yeah, it isn't. Newham isn't actually not short of land for housing. It doesn't have the resources to build housing. It's an entirely
different
issue. Well,
then you better tell Newham, because it's different to what they're telling
us.
Well,
Newham in that sense will tell you quite straightforward that they've been a rate capped authority You have a government which is actually discouraging local authorities from building more houses.
No, see, that's my biggest argument with the LDDC. Sick of hearing what you're doing for local communities. You're doing nothing at all. That Stalport down there, that wasn't accepted by the community. Out of 4,000 residents, we handed in 3,000 signatures against it.
They promised double glazing, all this kind of thing. Right, have we got double glazing, soundproofing?
No, we've got no double glazing and there's no word of it going through yet.
There you are.
What you got there is, you know, I mean, our little crib note is the surprise interview, but it's more like he agreed to be interviewed by a local Channel 4 group, and we chose to have interviewers who were the people he refused to talk to, because they're the experts on what was going on. I mean, it's part of a much longer interview. They were just some of the sort of choice moments. I think we did a slightly longer edit for that community about the Stalport, as it was called, short takeoff and landing airport, that they were using in their meetings in Europe. So that's a technique of, that's a demonstration, I should say, of rotating crew. I mean, that's just what happens when the crew rotates. But he was, you know, he thought he was going to have this nice PR, changing the perception. Presentation opportunity. It all went very pear-shaped very quickly. But we did quite a few sort of examples of that kind of thing, because it goes to the heart of who's the expert. And also that kind of, you know, all his kind of, you know, the big glass window with Tower Bridge in the background, that's real. That's not just like a Zoom background. That's his actual office background there. And suddenly it's all like not looking quite so, anyway, it's pretty disruptive to his, what he was trying to do. And it also kind of adds humour in there, you know. But this, what kept Despite TV alive, it didn't really have to pay any rent. We just used meeting room 2 hours a week and in the basement of the bookshop after the print shop stopped being needed because of desktop publishing. We just cleared it out and that's where we did our editing. So a group like that is sustainable for a very long time, and we did a huge amount of stuff because it was on the economy of desire. If people want to come into a room on a Thursday night and say, let's go and interview the chair of the LDDC, and get him on, you know, on the record about the Stalport or whatever. As long as people turn up to do that, you can do anything. There was no, you know, economic restriction. It was just about the passion, the desire, the anger, whatever it is that motivates people to go and do things like that. A lot of the stuff that Despite TV did was very important what was going on in East London. I mean, there was Brick Lane when Despite TV started, so, you know, not that long ago, in the 80s, was still the National Front, which was the fascist party in the UK. It was their street. It was the one place in London that they sold their bulldog newspaper. It was the one place where it was like, you know, kind of almost infested with neo-Nazi skinheads. The image that it has now, for those who know London, Brick Lane is held up by the sort of authorities as the sort of an achievement in multiculturalism. Actually, it was an achievement of militant Bengali youth, third generation youth, saying, but our parents might have put up with skinheads on the street, but we're not. And they went out and they transformed that. They cleansed the street of neo-Nazis, to be honest. I mean, that's the real history of Brick Lane and Whitechapel. You won't see any neo-Nazi. You might see fashion skinheads, but you won't see any neo-Nazis in East London. But that was all happening on our doorstep. There was the Tower Hamlets was a very clear, very, very poor borough right next to one of the richest parts of the planet. And there was no, you know, the city was starting to buy up bits of Tower Hamlets. The land was being, I mean, look at it now, land was being taken over by city office developments. The docks were shut down and turned into this kind of offshore, inland Hong Kong type environment with Canadian, North American style architecture and underground shopping malls and all this kind of malls and all this kind of stuff that, you know, you just don't, didn't exist before. So there were lots of things going on the ground, but we also developed a way. Well, one of the things that happened on our doorstep was the so-called Wapping dispute. The Wapping dispute was this, basically, Rupert Murdoch owned The Times, The Sun, newspapers, most of the big. I heard yesterday he owns 70% of Australian media still. You know, he's not. So he owned the big titles in the UK, and they were all based in what was called Fleet Street, because it's called Fleet Street. But that's where all the press was, buildings were. And what he did was basically overnight, he was telling everyone that he was going to build a new printing press because you couldn't keep that secret. But he told everyone who worked for News International they were going to launch a new newspaper. And then suddenly one Friday night, the entire workforce, some thousands of people, are told, don't come back on Monday, but you can come back and you can come back and a few could come back. But they basically just got rid of them all. And they were locked out of, and he moved his whole operation to Wapping. So Wapping has become a a shorthand for the Murdoch Press these days. So there was a big dispute, and the dispute went on for a year. And it was, the idea was going and picketing, standing there peacefully, kind of shouting abuse at all the scab labour that was bussed in armoured buses and stuff. But it was one of Thatcher's big moves. She'd taken on the miners, she'd beaten the miners. If she could beat the print union, that was pretty much the end of the trade union movement, as we know. That's where we are. And so it was quite a big event. It was right on our doorstep. So we decided, it was actually before the city, it was number 9, was Despite the Sun, which is the name of one of his newspapers, so Despite the Sun. And that was just about this Wapping dispute. And the Wapping dispute tended, because they were trying to stop the newspapers going out, they targeted the Sunday papers. So every Saturday night, there would be a big picket outside the gates. There was all every day small pickets, but big pickets with the aim of trying to stop the Murdoch media press delivering the Sunday papers, because they all had to come out the plant in big trucks and spread around the country. And there was another print one up in Warwick Midlands, but basically the strategy was to try and disrupt his business by stopping the Sunday papers being delivered. So this dispute went on for a year, and every time we did basic training, we said, look, you know, tonight we're the shoot tonight, 6 o'clock down outside the gates of Wapping. You know, new members would meet us down there. We'd be saying, so this is Focus, this is like Iris, this is Shutter Speed, on the picket line. And people were finding themselves like filming. We made sure that people weren't ever put in danger. Some of us did put ourselves in positions of danger, but we didn't let new people do that. But it was a process where we basically just gathered a lot of content by just going down there. What's the extract?
it's Wild Wild West Week and the Rootin' Tootin' Sun. Get this great sun pull out on how the West was really won.
Of basic trade union rights.
How could you, to your fellow
workers? Fighting a fight to save your jobs. Fighting a fight to save your industry. Fighting your fight.
And then it goes into a section that was about a women's demonstration. There were anti-page three women's demonstrations, women-only demonstrations. It's a kind of stream of consciousness about the issues around, but it was actually made by lots of little sections. This is another section.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right.
Scotland Yard say last night's violence outside the News International printing plant in East London was a deliberate and pre-planned attack on police.
We had cameras that we'd used. We got a little bit of money from the GLC. We had these kind of shoulder-mounted U-matic cameras that were quite big and bulky and were not very good in low light, and you needed to have a handheld light like the one I was showing you the other day, but they were actually quite expensive and they had bulbs in them that cost about £15. And every time we went out with the camera and a light, they had what are known as snatch squads, which is police who use the small shields. They're like attack squad. And they would like break rank from a line of police and just run straight towards us and smash the light, and sometimes try to smash the camera. So, I mean, I got hit a few times because they're trying to smash the camera and you're trying to protect it and you get hit. But the BBC got attacked, actually, and hospitalised by a snatch squad. So they tried not to let anyone film what was going on. And it just so happened at that time, that period of time, there was a new generation of low-light VHS cameras. So you could record on SVHS, which is using the same tapes but slightly faster. But you get this kind of streaky, you know, a light looks like a streak because it's using kind of what you now recognise as, you know, high ISOs and slow shutter speed. So it all looks like a very kind of sort of pastel coloured sort of, you know, something like a battle from the Middle Ages or something. But we were using a camera very proactively, so they didn't know where we were. because they would always know there they are filming over there. Let's just take that crew out. But when we didn't have to have a light, we were much more mobile, and we were running into particularly violent arrests and stuff and turning up with the camera from nowhere. And suddenly, like, we're there as a sort of civil defence for minimising police brutality, getting a record of individuals being... You know, there was a big inquiry. The 3rd of May was like a really big... There was a long, big investigation, which no doubt, like the vigil at Clapham Common, will take years to be published, and nothing will happen. Same happened there. But it was a really big investigation. So we were making something that was quite investigative, and we were starting to get used to the idea of, like, well, someone would say, do you have any record of, a friend of mine got badly beaten, but you don't by any chance have any video? We were about the only people who filmed any of it. Most media never wanted to antagonise Murdoch, and that's still true. So the BBC, when Kate Adey, some of you may know the name, when Kate Adey and her film crew were hospitalised on that 3rd of May, they tried to hospitalise us, but they didn't get us, but they got them. The BBC didn't even make a formal complaint. And Kate Adey was so pissed off, she went into self-exile and left the UK and was a foreign correspondent somewhere in Japan or something for a long time. So we were used to this idea that you could look at footage, not just from the point of view of, oh, this is footage, but this is, like we were saying in another session, this is data. You know, this is like you could, you know, well, maybe we do have a shot of that, or we have a shot of, you know, that person earlier in the evening. And, you know, there's all kinds of ways that you might use the material. And it was a film that we managed to finish about halfway through the dispute, which meant that it was actually the union who were fundraising bootlegged it, which we were kind of grateful for, because we couldn't afford to make 600 copies or whatever it was, but they bootlegged it and sold it on the picket line as a way of fundraising for the strike. There were loads of screenings. We launched it in a hall which had a capacity of 200 or 300 people, and it was sold out. People couldn't get in to watch it. And this is just local people. And there were lots of little spin-off, like, you know, there's a sit-down that you just start to see before that. What was it called again? A fade-out, yeah. But just before the... that was the beginning of a sit-down shoot, and that was used by the community in other meetings and blah, 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 and civil defence, group defence. So we had some experience of, the thing, it wasn't subtle. The cops would suddenly come out onto the street from the printing press, from the print plant. And amongst them, there would be people, there'd be all these uniformed cops in riot gear. And like every sort of one in 40 of them was someone in plain clothes and a motorbike helmet. And then later in the dispute, I'd be looking over my shoulder and there's a guy dressed exactly like that, throwing bricks at the police, going, come on, everyone, let's, you know. And that gives them an excuse to send the snatch squads in. So we were pretty well trained in how public order works. You know, there's all kinds of little subtle things that we learn. And some people have come, used our archive, because it would appear that the police deliberately target women on these kind of demonstrations so that the blokes try and go in to defend them. So they're not like picking a fight with the blokes, because that would be too obvious, but they kind of manhandle and push around the women. And of course, their partner or brother or friend or whatever, you know, might kind of, you know, push a riot cop away. Suddenly, bang, 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 they're all in, grab them, and they find themselves in the cell. So we learnt a lot. A few years later, in 1990, we were making a single-issue magazine about the poll tax. The poll tax was a tax that replaced a property progressive, you know, you pay, the bigger your property was, the more you pay type tax, with a poll tax, which means every individual, regardless of their personal wealth, pays a same amount. So you had, like, the richest man in the UK, the Duke of Westminster, paid £80 a year. But if you had a house in Brixton with an extended Caribbean, Afro-Caribbean family with, you know, some of the adults are unemployed and lower income, they all have to pay each the same as the Duke of Westminster. So, you know, people were a bit upset about that. But really, what we made our programme about, the theme of our Despite the Poll Tax, was that you can only enforce poll tax, and this was the real trick, if you have ID cards. The South African pass laws, that every black African had to have a pass, was when they kind of went into South Africa, no one wanted to work in the horrible factories and mills, so they said, well, you have to pay a tax, and the only way you can pay that tax is if you earn money in our mills. So it was like, that's the strategy. It also means you can track where everyone is. It's a colonial instrument. They did try introducing it in the UK in the 13th century, no, 14th century, I'm exaggerating, 14th century, 1381. And the peasants, the medieval peasants, thought it wasn't fair and revolted. It was the only, the peasants' revolt, you can look it up. It's the only real mass revolt in this country in sort of 2,000 years. And it was because they tried to introduce a poll tax. So the poll tax was actually about having to have data pass. Identity cards, how do you know if people have paid it if you can't track who they are? And this was an issue that was being ignored in the mainstream media, I mean, as it's known now, but the media wasn't. Everything in the media was about how unfair it was economically. We were looking at it from a social, political, surveillance, policing angle. So we'd nearly finished our magazine. It was made up. It was all a bit of this and a bit of that, bits of humour and playing around with, I think the opening scene is a map from the original poll tax painting that opens up like the old TV show Bonanza, where it burns out from the middle and stuff like that. And it was just it was very playful, but it had lots of quite hard-hitting points about what poll tax implications were. And we thought, well, it would be really good just to go and film some scenes for the opening and ending credits. There was a big demonstration planned, 31st of March, in Trafalgar Square. And we had three cameras, and we thought, well, let's put one near the end, one at the front, near the front, and one in the middle of the march. And it was almost, I think we did have one mobile phone with us, but the battery ran out after 2 hours. You know, one of those sort of brick ones. We're talking about 1990, sorry. Let's watch this. This is the opening. It was broadcast on Channel 4, actually.
On March 31st, 200,000 people from all over the country arrived in London to attend an anti-poll tax demonstration. Within hours, TV news was reporting a battle between demonstrators and the police.
Tens of thousands of people demonstrated against the poll tax in central London, rallying in Trafalgar Square.
The head of the march was still pouring into the square as the first trouble started in Downing Street.
The first trouble came with a sit-down protest at Downing Street.
The officer in charge of the operation believes the hardcore wanted to storm Downing Street. They blame the minority of anarchists and extremists who they say regularly hijack demonstrations.
Violence was caused by around 3,000 among them. At one point, mounted police charged a crowd of demonstrators. A woman in their path was knocked down and run over by horses. Then the looting began.
At this stage, the square had been turned into a virtual battleground. But running street battles are continuing and have spread to the area around Leicester Square, where cars are being overturned and shop windows are being smashed.
There have been more than 300 arrests, many by police snatch squads. Tonight, the hooligans have taken over.
As police cleared the square, some tried to remember what the demonstration had been all about.
Despite TV was present filming the demonstration, our experience of the event was dramatically different from that portrayed by TV news. What you're about to see, like all television, has been edited. In this programme, the key events of that day are shown in the order that they occurred. This has been achieved through examining many hours of material, statements and interviews. The story of the demonstration is told by eyewitnesses. For some, it was the first time they had been on a demonstration. A few have chosen to remain anonymous.
So this is a film that we actually made under exactly the same way that we had made the first, you know, magazines, but with a TV budget coming through the organisation. We were a group of about eight people. No one had actually made a broadcast programme before. We developed this kind of approach to looking at the footage we have in a completely kind of forensic approach. So what we did is we came back from that event. We tried to interview as many people as we possibly could who we knew, like through networks and people. And during the interview we would say, and roughly what time was that? And, you know, can you remember, was that before or after this happened, or do you remember anything significant going on that we would help time that? And the actual final film is just made up of a collective storytelling by eyewitnesses cut together with the footage of what was happening at the time they're describing. Very kind of straight, you know, in a way, fairly simple. The film went out 6 months after the event at 9 o'clock on a midweek prime time, and it absolutely created shockwaves through. It completely overturned the official narrative. It talked about how the official narrative, exactly how and why it had been distorted. It was used in court cases where people who were swept up in arrests on the day had what was called a common defence, and they showed the film in the court as a way, you know, because it was the most, you know, challenge this version of the events if you like, but this is actually what really happened. So, you know, to put it very simply, the news, you know, the news turn up, they go to Scotland Yard, they say, what happened? Scotland Yard said, well, it was, but I thought that demonstration was, it was peaceful until they started looting and then we had to go in. Well, actually, that's absolutely not what happened. You know, or they were going to attack South Africa House, so we had to go in and protect South Africa House. And what we showed is that they were completely overturning the narrative. And that opening sequence, you can, when you know the content, you can see that what they say, this happened and then that happened. But this, what, you know, you can see it's brighter, obviously, earlier in the day in the thing that they're showing you as what happened after this. So, you know, it wasn't that difficult to do, but that's just the stories out there. You know, we had no right of reply as people who had been on the demonstration. There was, you know, 100,000 people there, and all of them went home out to their communities and saying, what you're watching on TV is just not how it happened. And so when that programme was broadcast, there was a huge groundswell of people saying, thank Christ, at last the story's out there. It was used in court cases. Some people think it was one of the things that kind of, one of the things that knocked Thatcher off her throne, because it was so contentious. It was revealing a kind of corruption of news and policing, and the film was devastating. And it was made by a bunch of people. The only thing we had is we were pissed off. from our experience. So we were prepared to do it. And how we got funding is that we tried to get Channel 4, which we made despite the city. They went, oh, you know, we can't really broadcast things like that. And we showed them another film, you know, they'd seen the Whopping film. And it just so happens that we had a meeting the day after that event with Channel 4. And it was a meeting where it was like the end of the road for us. Like, you know, if they were, we'd put given them some proposals, and if they were going to say no to that, those proposals, that was the end of the game over, really, for Despite TV. And we went to this meeting, and of course they told us it was game over. And we just flipped. You know, they had a big open plan office with a sort of typing pool in the middle and glass walls in all the offices. And we just sort of said, for fuck's sake, you know, why don't you just take a risk? Why don't you just give us, like, you know, look what we did with $5,000 development money with Despite the City. Why don't you just give us $10,000 or something so we can make a pilot? I don't think we gave a figure, we just said development. And there were people, you know, in the other parts of the, what the hell's going on in Alan Fountain's office, and, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And anyway, so to cut a long story short, he kind of went, yeah, okay then. And he gave us a little bit of development money. And when that, Alan Fountain is the man who basically built the, single-handedly the reputation of Channel 4 as being a radical broadcaster. And the origins of Channel 4 is that people like me and others were campaigning for a fourth channel to show different stuff than what the BBC and ITV. It actually came out of political lobbying. And it was a construct about, okay, well, we could give a little percentage of advertising money to fund. That's still its business model. And it was given a remit to do different things. So, yeah, it could show football, but it showed Italian football. So even the mainstream stuff, it was have to do something to show that it was doing something different. So, of course, they ended up spending all their money on Big Brother, and that's the end of that story. But that we got some money to make a film. And we handled a $50,000 budget coming through our little Mickey Mouse weekly meetings. I think we started having a few Sunday afternoon meetings. We'd use a bit of Channel 4's money to get, you know, feed everyone, like get some Indian takeaway or something, and so that we could do a good work session. And what we decided to do is we said, okay, we used to only kind of validate task work, and everything else you did was just voluntary. But what we said, we'll carry on just working voluntary, so anyone could say, oh, I could come in tomorrow and do some offline editing, some assistant editing type work. I've got a day off, I could come in, or I could, okay, I can come in at the weekend, not in morning. And people could volunteer, and everyone could keep a record. At the end of every meeting, we'd say, okay, how many hours did everyone work? And everyone would say, I did 10 hours, 15, and we'd write it all down. We had a maximum, because some people had more capacity to do more work, but we had a maximum, I think it was like 15, 20 hours. So even if you worked 60, you couldn't claim more. But that was just to avoid sort of, you know, like I said, too much of a disparity. So, and the agreement was, is at the end, if there was any money left, we'll just add up how many hours we'd all done, divide it up and by that number, and everyone would get paid, I don't know, 55p an hour for what they'd been doing to make the film. And it ended up being quite low, because all of that archive, you see, we had to pay for that out of the budget. So a very large part of the $50,000 budget went on paying to be able to tell that story. And it was a bit awkward because Channel 4 gets its news from ITN. We had analysed a lot of the news footage and we're thinking, well, hang on a minute, that looks like ITN, Independent Television News, has got a camera in the top of South Africa House, a camera on the roof of Canada House, a camera up that's opposite the alcohol shop, on the first floor, you can see from the shots where, you know, you could look at what the news reported, look at the camera angles. So we're thinking, well, that's a bit strange. This was meant to just be a demonstration, and ITN's turned up with like six crews. You know, normally they don't pay any attention. I don't know if there was any official crews at the Clapham vigil, for instance. Probably not. For them to have all those cameras, but what you're really watching, and this is what we showed in the film, is that on the TV news, they show the bit of that guy pulling the grill off the front of the van, and then they cut. Now, that's a very, smart camera operator who thinks that, oh, this looks interesting. I'm just going to switch the camera off here because I don't think that nothing's going on. Because we showed in the edit that within a second of that edit, the vans drive into that crowd that's in front of them. So let's watch the rest of it.
5, 10, 15 minutes later, as the crowd surged in front of me, was a very surreal scene of police transit vans moving through a crowd at a speed that I would say must have been at least 30 or 40 miles an hour. And they were moving through people as if they were a boat moving through the sea. I'm just so unsurprised that people got angry.
You got that, yeah?
And this is a nun, actually. Just play. Does it play from here? If you look at the van, the guy's just like trying to provoke the crowd by waving to them. Next
people
van.
People were jumping out of the way. Honestly, I just thought people were going to be.
Here it comes. Watch this next one.
And they leapt out, and it was like putting a match to a tinder.
He's like waving like that out the window. Just let it play, because I think you need to see the next shot. So there's a van now on the edge of a square. There are people trying to sort of block it in. I mean, you're always going to get people like this, but they're just like pissed off at this stage. This is the police response to our questions. They had to answer us because we said, well, if you don't tell us, we're just going to say, this is what we're going to say. And so this is their response. Annoyingly, it means we have to.
Suddenly, out of nowhere, this police van drove into the crowd. And it was driving really fast, about 40 miles an hour. And the road was jam-packed.
And it just, you know, swung out 45 degrees into this full crowd who were totally naive. And people who were standing from my vantage point could see what was going on. People behind had no idea of that van about to accelerate.
The media coverage, when I saw the RTN news, it was all...
So these are the vans, and look, they actually kind of just drive through that crowd. That
20-year-old youth was arrested the other day and charged with attempted murder of the police driver. Nobody asked the questions how that police car got there. When the police vans went into the crowd, the chap had been injured, and we went over to see if we could help him. And the police were trying to arrest him. And there was basically a block of about, I'd say, 12 people ready to stop the police in any way or form they could.
The vans arrived at Whitehall, where within minutes, the riot police charged into the square, soon followed by horses.
That was what everyone on the ground thought it felt like. A peaceful demonstration, they drive vans. By the way, they did it in New York against Black Lives Matter as well, and we tried to show them these extracts. But so it's still being done. It's like how you can have an excuse to send the horses and the riot cops in, actually, without any jeopardy. Like I said, they're bulletproof vans. The people inside are in no danger. I'm sure it's terrifying to be in it, but you're actually not in danger. And that completely changes the whole narrative, of course. But the idea that ITN had six cameras there, and the news doesn't even mention that, is what really pissed off ITN, because we asked them, how many cameras did you... We wrote a formal thing. How many cameras... We wanted an interview. How many cameras did you have? Who edited it? Were all those cameras yours, or were some of them police cameras? Was the thing that really upset them. because I think we had hit it on the head. That they're independent meant they were dependent on what the police gave them. And later in the film, they talk about how the narrative, the editors will cut pictures to fit the voiceover, and that's why you get something at 4 o'clock being cited as the inciting incident that created what happened at 1 o'clock or the other, you know, type thing, because it was trying to fit the pictures to a story that didn't make sense. So we were touching a raw nerve with this film, but it went out. It got one of the highest viewing figures for a very high viewing figures for a documentary, because they're always quite small. It won an award in a film festival without anyone ever asking how it was made. We nearly won a couple of awards in the sense that we were like second or third and stuff, but we actually won some actually outright. And the man who we berated in his office, Alan Fountain, when he came to leave Channel 4 after 10 years, and it was a big sort of farewell Alan event, and he made a speech, and he said in his speech there were a few highlights of his career, and he mentioned that film as one of the highlights of his career. And so it made entirely, we didn't shut down the membership of Despite TV, we didn't change how we worked, we didn't change how we handled the money, we didn't change our decision making, we did everything on consensus, everything was voluntary. And the final film is like now held up as like one of the very first camcorder films, camcorder journalism films. So and Alan Fountain at the time said to that if his comment, and it was said in a sort of public arena of, you know, the industry kind of, he said if the BBC would have needed an army of journalists to make that film, and we just made it because we were pissed off and wanted to know what the truth was, and it wasn't a job to us. It wasn't something we did today and tomorrow we're on another story. We stuck with it. So it just shows you what you can do. I mean, obviously, as I said, we went there just to get some good big crowd shots, which we use in the film, of course. But that was what motivated us to go there. It was 1990, and by that time I'd been working at Despite TV for 10 years. I kind of thought, 10 years is long enough doing anything, so I should. And I like the idea of working that way, but I didn't want to carry on working in East London. So I went on a kind of walkabout, a sort of just an aimless derive around Europe. I started out in Zurich. I went to this kind of formation of a new urbanistic group called Enora. If there's any urbanists amongst you, Enora, I can talk to you about another time. And at this founding meeting, there was a guy, there's only about 12, 15 of us, there was a guy called Carl Otto Richter, who was a professor at Rostock University. And I was showing Despite the Sun, and he came up to me in the meal afterwards and said, look, would you be interested in coming to Rostock and helping a group in Rostock set up a media group? Because Rostock is in East Germany. East Germany, once the wall came down, the West kind of stormed in, shut down all of the local press, local media, and the Springers came in and took over everything and the big media corporations. So what he was saying is that the kind of people who were the people who faced up to the, you know, faced down the Soviet Union, were going out on marches, candle marches, setting up the House of Democracy and all this, that they had no voice, and they wanted, you know, that generation, if you like, they weren't looking just to overthrow the Soviet Union so they could get McDonald's. They were at that time very interested in some kind of third way concept. So of course, it was almost like, well, I couldn't have made up an event like that? And of course I said, absolutely. And very quickly, I was up in Rostock via Berlin. And I went up there and met the people there. And they said, you know, can you come and set up this group? So we actually set up a group in Rostock that was completely on the model of Despite TV. And we made a cooperative. It was called Jacko. I don't know why. That was the name they wanted to call it. Our approach was exactly what we did with you. We showed everyone the footage. We documented some of this as well. We showed everyone how to use the cameras. We did an interview exercise. We did an exercise, go out and film the neighborhood. Let's come back and view and crit. And what interested me the most was the impact of the kind of last battle of the Cold War on the urban environment. For instance, the big square in the centre of Rostock near the university, McDonald's opened up and they just used the whole square as their private terrace. It was just unbelievable, the kind of brutal capitalism that was going in there. So this was the and this was exactly the kind of stuff that you could go and film today if it wasn't very well filmed. We view and crit, talk about it, they can go back the next day and get it right. And we, as outsiders, Siobhan, who you saw in that film, she went there with me as well, and we were able to go and do our, like, this is what interests me about Rostock. So we became like participants on a more equal basis because of that structure that I've talked about. And 6 months later, there was an event in Rostock, which completely took everyone by surprise. Before we show it to you, I was yet again knocking on Channel 4's door saying, there's some really interesting stuff. I mean, we're talking about soon after the wall came down. You know, there was no telephones in Rostock, for instance. When I first went there in November 90, there were not even police, because there was no DDR and they hadn't been signed up to the West German police. So there was like a policeless society. No one had anything worth burgling anyone for. Everyone had the same stuff. It was a very strange place. Everyone's had no security, no police, and very interesting space. And we tried to talk to Channel 4 about doing this, and they were a bit like, well, we've done the fall of the wall. You know, like, they've done the Iraq War. If they do one documentary about the Iraq War, that's it, you know, for that channel. So they were saying, no, we've done the collapse of the Soviet Union. And then, and so we ran out of steam. We had a group, it was set up. They were kind of trying to survive and keep it going. And then the events that we're going to show you in this film suddenly erupted. And because there was a group, a local media group, we managed to get a camera into a situation and record it. And around this, we built a whole documentary. But let's just show the opening or the intro.
Mr. Kranke, a police radio operator in Lytton Klein, on duty that night, heard and wrote down in his log 5 demands from the Reuters. The police to withdraw, a police car with loudspeakers to announce intentions to the crowd, to look inside the refugee reception center, a free passage home, meeting with commanding police officers at a newspaper kiosk. There's no evidence that police agreed to these demands. However, they did withdraw. In effect, they met the first demand.
So that's it's not exactly an extract, it's using bits from the film. I think the main thing to say about the film, Nicola, if we queue up the, I think Saturday morning is the stuff we'll do for the forensic. Just, but the what's happened there, I should have maybe given you a bit of context, maybe. But basically, there was neo-Nazis attacked a refugee home, an asylum home, that was also next door to a home with Vietnamese guest workers, so that basically the only non-Germans in the whole of this huge estate. And it went on for 3 days. Rostock is about a 2-hour car drive from Berlin and about 20 minutes by helicopter. But it went on for 3 days. And our film was full of what they call in English scoops, news stories that no other news agencies have had. And believe me, when neo-Nazis, the spectre of neo-Nazism rising in East Germany, the world's media descended on Rostock for that week, reporting about rise of the Nazis. And but again, they would go and interview the mayor or that chief of police who you saw in our film, and the inner minister who you see who was interviewed there as well, and they get the official version and they go away and they report that. And there was all, and we collected every single bit of published newspaper, magazine, recorded all the off TV thing. And the whole discourse was about what's wrong with the youth. Nothing's wrong with the youth. What's wrong is that was basically a kind of planned event. They'd had it even, if you study German history, it was almost their second attempt to create a situation that would make it so they could change the German constitution to say no more immigrants. You can't come into under the Second World War, post Second World War German constitution, they had to give asylum to asylum seekers who arrived at their border, and they used that event as a reason to change that forever. There was so many things wrong with the official story. And by this time, we were quite hardened to these kind of possibilities and ways of looking at things, being, cynical and stuff. For instance, the reason why there was some media there was because the police called the media there to say, we're going to go and do a raid on the docks because there's a big heroin drugs bust. Follow us. And then, oh, there's something going on down the road. Let's go over there instead. So they brought the media with them. And we knew from some of our work on the poll tax and other things that when the police turn up with the media, you know there's something wrong going on. How did we know there was media there? Well, the only footage we had was some footage, because there was a group cooperative where some residents in the actual Vietnamese guest workers, we could get a camera into their hands, and they were filming from the block that was under attack. And it was pretty dodgy footage. It's your classic amateur. It's kind of swinging around. But there was someone from Jacko who went there with them and was trying to help them. But the funny thing is that the Jacko camera battery ran out really fast, and they used one of the Vietnamese's cameras he was going to buy to take back to Vietnam, and he didn't know how to use it, but he got stuff. And the whole of the film, it's a 78 minute feature long documentary that was made just based on 30 minutes of really wobbly VHS stuff, but we use that to analyze the kind of stuff that was going on and investigated and built on it. We used our We were given a room in the attic of the House of Democracy and a phone. Someone found us a phone so we could talk to Channel 4 occasionally. And we were there for 8 months working with the Jacko group, completely under workshop despite TV framework and rules. And we made this film, which is, even today, is shown all over Germany. I've barely met a German who hasn't seen the film, either at school or at university or somewhere, some screening somewhere. When we finished the film, it was shown in the local theatre, the Volkskammer, for something like 6 weeks. It was an old Soviet tradition that you would, that it was like a big social place that you could all go, and people were full house for 6 weeks for local Rostockers to watch it. The reaction of most Rostocker people was, at last, here's a Rostocker true version of what happened. It was actually made by some Rostockers and two people who hardly spoke German from London. And we had to make a film. By this time, we actually managed, once that was a global story, it was like a seller's market, and happily we managed to get Channel 4 to commission us to make the full film so we could go there, live there. They let us use the money like we did in Despite TV. So because there was supposed to be budget, very unionised, the film industry at that time. So you could have budget for hotel and food, and we just used it for archive. And we sofa surfed, and we paid rent to people in the group, you know, if they gave us a room to stay in. And we used some of the budget to pay for a production office in the House of Democracy, which meant that this phone bill was paid and photocopying expenses were covered. So because of open accounting, we were able to say, this is the money that's allocated for me and Javon to stay in a hotel. Bang, here you go, let's put it in the middle. They spent a fortune, that group, on archive, because that sequence you saw, most of that isn't our footage. We had to pay for that. So again, this group worked for 10 months, knowing that the more archive we used, the less they were going to get paid. We used the same basic model. The film has won awards, prestigious documentary awards, without anyone asking us how it was made, like with the Battle of Trafalgar. Most people don't know it was a participatory film. The work we did in Brussels, for instance, was another kind of model of participation, where I showed Truth Lies in Rostock, got invited by a guy who was working in like an area a bit like Tower Hamlets, a lot of poverty, mainly immigrant communities. Turkish, Moroccan, elderly Flemish community, blah blah blah, and there were going to be some changes in the neighbourhood, and Axel, who asked me to work with him, was interested in kind of countering a little bit the municipal plan of, you know, give me that European money, we're just going to make what we want type thing. And one of the strategies we did there was we did little workshops in each of the community's locations. So we worked in the Moroccan youth club, we did some stuff in workshops in a Turkish youth club, Flemish pensioners group, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then we started to have meetings, you know, regular meetings, but we would say, well, next meeting is down in the Moroccan youth club. And the Turkish youth were going, well, I'm sorry, but we can't go there. And we're saying, well, if you want to be in the group, you're going to come. And all the Moroccan guys want you to come. We work with them. We know them. You know, and the Flemish, our elderly Flemish. So we were having, like, we were using the workshops as a way to get people who would never get together in the same room by work, building up a little bit of a relationship with each of them separately, and then saying, so from now on, you know, the next meeting's down the Flemish Pensioners Centre, you know. So suddenly the people who, you know, maybe the Flemish pensioners are scared of these Moroccan youth who hang on the, you know, suddenly they're all mates, they know each other, they're all working on a video project together. So there's lots of really interesting things that you can do. And we'll just show you a little extract of me and Axel going out with a group of about six or seven from one of the youth clubs in the neighbourhood. And again, we're just giving them a little bit on the, you know, so this is focus and this, so okay. This is Axel. Donne à
quelqu'un qui commence. Comme on se retrouve ici, 5 heures par suite, on se
retrouve. That's Eric Cantona. Some very basic training right there on the street. And this was the event, and they just went around and got some shots. So you might not recognise it, but that's a Belgian policeman, Brussels policeman. It's really rotten around here. There's too many Moroccans. Are you racist? No, it's just what I think. But aren't you a Moroccan? No, I'm Tunisian. So there's suddenly there's all this sort of mayhem going on, and it's just like a real, it's just what they filmed when they went out. And I mean, you know, as I said, we would also go out and film some stuff as well, but that was how they all got to know each other. You know, like, what do you mean there's too many Moroccans? Well, you know, I'm Tunisian, you know. I mean, they're sort of it's playful, and they're getting together, and they're kind of mixing it up a bit, and they're visible on the street with cameras, which meant we were able to get other people involved in the workshops. And, you know, we developed a whole kind of, you know, quite a strong environment in a group in Brussels, and we worked in a few different neighbourhoods. And one of the projects, when this is where we'll really well finish, is that there was what's called the sans-papier, the people without papers, the people who aren't regulated in Brussels. They were all put in a church. You can get asylum in some European countries if you go in the church. So there was a big church in the centre of Brussels that was letting all the so-called sans-papier live there. And and I'd had some contact with them anyway prior to that, but there was a fire in the church. Fancy that! So they all had to move out. And me and Axel and someone from this group in Aura that I'm part of, we actually found a place for them to go. We arranged for them to go to a sports hall in the VUB, the Free University of Brussels. And then when the Free University of Brussels said we want our sports hall back, we found another place for them to go, which we filmed some of that stuff, of them moving into the new sports hall and all this kind of stuff. And much later, after, you know, maybe a year or so later, we were asked if we would buy, like, the equivalent of the Belgian sort of Commission for Racial Equality, a big sort of umbrella NGO, kind of quasi-government type, about addressing racism and prejudice and stuff. And they asked us if we would make a little film that they could use. So what we did is we set up a very simple, we found an empty room in a building on the top floor. We set up a little filming setup, and the only thing Axel and I did is we planned that we would ask people one basic question, which is, what will you do when you get your papers? So you're irregular now, you're illegal now, but what difference would it make to get your papers? So the film's called When the Papers Arrive in French. And what we did is we, Axel had a whole load of old new wallpaper samples. There they all are. And what we did is we had, down on the ground floor, we had a sort of cafe meeting room area where people could congregate, because it was almost like waiting for their appointment. You know, next, dentist. Oh, no, my interview. And they would be interviewed by another sans-papier, as we do, rotating round. And obviously, sometimes we're talking in not French or Flemish or English, but in another mother tongue, so they would be interviewed by someone who spoke that. And downstairs on the ground floor, everyone could choose a wallpaper for their background, but we framed the image so it looked like, and lit it so it looked like a passport photo, so playing around with that passport and home idea. So everyone's chosen their background, and everyone's going to just say the theme is, what's your, you know, why are you in Brussels and what will you do when you get your papers? Was basically the question. The power, we'll show you the clip in a second, but the power of the project actually was down on the ground floor where people are choosing their wallpaper and waiting to go up. That's actually where the action happened because, you know, if you're a Tunisian immigrant, you don't know Iranian immigrants. You know, you don't meet them. You know, the world might see you as all as immigrants, but there's no... So we actually created an environment where all these disparate... And Brussels is pretty international. All these different immigrant groups were all meeting each other and working on this little project. It was a day event. But it actually led to those people coming together with us and a few sort of squattery type people we know who basically, there was an abandoned embassy. I think it was the Sudanese or Yemeni embassy was abandoned. And they opened it up and called it the Universal Embassy. And it was where we put, you know, they just took it over and ran it as a sort of home advice centre in. But that wasn't what we were commissioned to do. We were commissioned to make this. This film is like a kind of click and play website. This is an extract from it. And, well, it was the whole film, but we're just going to show you an extract. And it was, copies were made, DVD copies were made and distributed to every school in Belgium. It was shown on the news. Different extracts were shown every night on the news after the sort of 9 o'clock news.